Okay, everyone. Thanks for joining us. For the ones that we have here online with us, and the many more who listen at different times and who email me, we're having a new semester, if we can call it a semester. Today is February 27th. I guess it's no longer Rosh Chodesh, but it was Rosh Chodesh Adar today, 2017. This semester, we're going to be focusing on the figure you see at present, Rav Yaakov Moshe Charlap, as well as maybe I hope to get to Rav Aaron Cutler as well, but those who've been with us before know that even though I plan maybe three or four classes, sometimes it ends up to be five or six. But being that, we don't have a time that we have to finish or a date we need to finish, that doesn't bother me. So if we go an extra one or two times, especially since Rav Charlap, who we see right now, is really an unusual figure. And I decided to do him because he follows very closely on Rav Isser Zalman Meltzer and the era. And as well, he has many interesting aspects. But before we get to him, I just want to respond to two questions or two points, and then we'll get right into it. The first is, one of you, we had a lot to do with Rabbi Isser Zalman Meltzer, and a number of people did send me emails, like thank you, pointing out things I wasn't aware of, and calling attention to other aspects. I really don't want to start going through all the emails and revisiting that simply because it would take us another class or two just to revisit Zalman Meltzer, but I was happy to see that many people found the classes interesting and that they found his life of interest. But just one point, because maybe I wasn't clear, so let me say it again about his, if you recall his book, Rav Isser Zalman Meltzer's commentary on the Mishneh Torah is known as Evan Ha'azel. At least that's how most people call it. And I made the claim that I don't think it should be called Evan Ha'azel. So let me explain what I mean by this. If you look in the book, it says, V'yashavta etzel ha'Evan Ha'azel, that you will remain by the Ezel stone. So the word is Ezel, not Azel. However, in Hebrew, the way it works is that when a word is at the end of a sentence, or it could be in the middle, like in Esnachta, then it changes from two segels to the first one of comets and then a segel. So for instance, Gashem. If Geshem is at the end of a sentence, it's not Geshem, it becomes Gashem. And the big dispute we have is, Mashiv HaRuach HaMorid HaGeshem, is that the end or is it not? And the truth is that, and Art Scroll gets this right, that it should be Geshem, at least that's the tradition. This was changed a couple hundred years ago in many Sidurim to Gashem, but it really should be Geshem. And Art Scroll, historically here, so many times Art Scroll was historically not correct. In this case, Art Scroll is actually correct, and really Geshem is the authentic way of reciting it. Similarly, Geffen. We say Borei Pri HaGafen, because it's the end of the sentence. Sfardim, or most Sfardim, in fact, maybe even all Sfardim, say Borei Pri HaGeffen. It's very difficult to understand this. By Mazuz, those who've been listening long enough or reading me know that I'm a big fan, although he is, of course, a Sephardic authority. He has, in his Sidur and his writings, has made changes. And one of the changes is he says that in this the Ashkenazim are correct. And all of his followers who now use his Siddur, it's called the Hasidur HaMeduyak. You might have seen it. It's quite a popular Siddur. It's used by all the Tunisians, and it's used by many other Sfaradim. They are the word meduyak, meaning, exact. They also have the Tikkun HaMeduyak and many other things called meduyak in there. He has changed it, and he says that everyone, including Sfaradim, that's who he's writing for, should say Borei Pri HaGafen In fact, just a few days ago, a book came out. It's a second edition, but updated, called Lindor Peretz. And it's an attack against Rabbi Mazur. All great people have something to add, and they've all made changes like this. We don't make it, but they do. If you go to the Maimonides Synagogue in Boston, you'll see in the Kaddish that everyone says, they do it a little differently. They remove a word, and I forget now which word it is, in the Kaddish, because that was Rabbi Soloveitchik's idea. The fact that no one in history has ever said that Kaddish, the fact that the Rambam we have is Kaddish, who doesn't say it, Rabbi Soloveitchik on his own came up with this thing that the Kaddish said. Because if you're saying, let's say you say, in the Evan HaEzel argues, you shouldn't say the Evan HaEzel argues. You should say the Evan HaEzel argues, because it's not the end of a sentence. Now, granted, we're speaking in English here, but I still think that there's nothing wrong with saying, as you speak, you know, say, because the word is only Azo when it's at the end of a sentence in Hebrew. If you're speaking in English, then I don't think it ever should be Azo. It always should be Ezel. And definitely if you say, use it the way I just said it. So that was my point. I hope it's clear now. If not, I can explain it again. Okay, the second point I want to answer is Yisrael was with us here, and he raises a good question, which it's good to mention now before we even go into the class. Because Rav Karlap is going to be a little different than the figures we've done up until now, or many of the figures, in that we've had many great Torah scholars and leaders, but Ethan's correct. Maimonides omits Vayitalel. And no one could explain to me exactly. They gave me some reason, but it was hard for me to understand it, because the Rambam's version has it. So, okay, what do I mean by Rav Karlap is different? Because Rav Karlap is also known as a tzaddik. Think of the Chafetz Chaim as a tzaddik. Rav Karlap is known as one of these pietists, one of these super holy people, someone who even the Brisker Rav, Rav Elvo Soloveitchik, sent people to get a bracha from. We have many, many great Torah scholars. We don't have many people who stand out as, you know, obviously we assume they're all tzaddikim in the sense that they're righteous, but when I say a tzaddik, I mean someone who's very special, holy, and who's regarded, that the first thing you think of is you regard him as a tzaddik. And Rav Karlap falls into that category. What can I say? Most people who make it big, they make it big because of their great knowledge. And they can't be big if they're thought not to be also a righteous person. But their righteousness is not what stands front and center. I'm assuming that all our great Torah scholars are also righteous. There's plenty of people who are also great scholars but are not righteous. But piety is usually not front and center, it's scholarship. So Yisrael asks a very good question. How did we ever get to the point, however, where the be-all and end-all, especially of the people we've been looking at, is Torah study? It's like, that's what you live for. So, of course, it says that Torah study keneged kulam, but there's other mitzvot. They're also regarded as equal to everything. And if you look in the Talmud, if you look in the Bible and other things, that Torah study as the be-all and end-all is not the point of life. Torah study is important, obviously, but it's more important is to do mitzvot, and even the study of Torah study. If you look before the Lithuanian Revolution, the point was to study in order to know how to practice. So Yisrael asks, where does this come from, and how widespread is this, and is that the way we're supposed to be? Look, I can't tell how you're supposed to be. I can say that once you leave the Lithuanian yeshiva world, if you go into the Sephardic world, for instance, Ravad Yosef polemicizes against this approach. If you go into the religious Zionist world, obviously, Torah study is important, but there are other values that are also important. Settling the land, making a living and supporting family. I mean, all sorts of things. So this is something new, I think, and it's hard to see this as you know, to take this mitzvah, Torah study, and see it as the only important thing versus other mitzvot. Rav Kook also thought that Torah study is important, obviously, but for some people, it's not going to be the most important. For some people, they'll do other things. So it's take it or leave it, but that's the Lithuanian approach, and that's become the be-all and end-all. But I understand, Yisrael, your disappointment that so many other mitzvot have been pushed aside. I can just tell you that when I was in yeshiva, and we asked, could we go one afternoon and do chesed? I don't know what that would have meant, go to a hospital or something like that, because all we were doing is learning day and night. And we were told no, that other people can do chesed, that what we're doing learning Torah is more important than chesed, and we should sit and just do that, and even to spend a few hours a week doing chesed. Rav Aaron Lichtenstein has an essay on hesder, and he opposes this approach, and so he argues for hesder, that the students in yeshiva should go to the army, and he argues from the stand. He doesn't argue like other people do, that we have to pull our weight, and why should we get exempt? He argues from the standpoint of chesed, that just because you're a Torah scholar, an average Torah scholar, we're not talking about super elites, doesn't mean that you're exempt from chesed. And yes, and Moshe points out that the sages of the Talmud, well, they all worked for a living, and they they were named for other things they did, that Nachum Ish Gamzu, and people who were known for other things. But we're going to see right now a different approach with Rav Charlap, in other words, a different characteristic. And since you bring it up, Yisrael, I just want to quote you something. I haven't yet put this on the Svarim blog, but one day I will. It comes from Rav Avraham Price. Rav Avraham Price was really the leading rabbi in Toronto for many years, and one of his students was Rabbi Gedalia Felder, and he wrote a number of books, most famously a commentary on the Smag and on the Sefer Chassidim, which is a huge, thick book. But he has another book of drashot called Imre Chaim. And if you look in Parshas Chayesara, and thank you, Yisrael, for asking your question, because I hadn't thought of this passage in a long time, and it reminds me I have to put it on the blog one day. He asked the following question. The Talmud says, if you see someone that difficulties, problems, Yisurim, come on him, what are you supposed to do? You're supposed to examine your actions. And then the Gemara says, it's in Brachos. If you examine your actions and you didn't find anything that is anything you did bad that would explain why you're suffering, you know, attribute it to Bittul Torah. Attribute it to that, you know, Bittul Torah, that you didn't study Torah. And he asks, Rav Avraham Price asks, he actually says it's a famous question, that if in Yesh Bo Bittul Torah, if it's because of Bittul Torah, how can you see it? You searched and you didn't find. In other words, the point of this Gemara is that if you don't know why difficulties or why bad things are happening to you, search. And then, you know, see what you've done wrong. And if you can't find anything, attribute it to Bittul Torah. So the question is obvious. Well, if you're in Mevatel Torah, if you're not learning, of course, it's obvious. Instead of learning Torah, you're playing around. You're doing other things. So how could you say that attribute it to Bittul Torah only if you searched and you didn't find anything? That should be front and center. So what does Rabbi Price explain? This is in the name of the Kutzker. So obviously we're getting a Hasidic Shavuot, a little anti-Litva Shavuot here. And I believe he was from Poland, Rabbi Price. So even though he's a great Talmudist, he had some of this Hasidus. He says as follows. Hakavana, what's the meaning of it? Shelo ratza lasok b'mitzvot Hashem. That the person who these things are happening to didn't want to be involved in mitzvot. All sorts of mitzvot, helping the poor people, delivering food to the elderly. Uvatzarachet Sibor, and he didn't want to be involved in communal activities. He didn't want to be on the local school board. Why not? Mipnei sheyisiare mibitul Torah, because he says it's bitul Torah. Exactly what happened when I was in yeshiva. Don't go out and do chesed, because it's bitul Torah. And what does Rabbi Price say? Ze'avon plili. It's a terrible thing. Because the entire Torah has only come to teach us how to help and do good for others. And don't be afraid and worry about yourself on this. So in other words, what does it mean? when it says, if you see in Roa Adam Shiasurim Bayalav, if you see that bad things come upon you, and you looked for the reason and you didn't find it, attributed to Bittul Torah, it doesn't mean that you weren't learning Torah. It meant that attributed to the fact that you didn't do what you should have done because you said it's Bittul Torah. It's hard to see that as pshat in the Gemara, but it's still a wonderful pshat that's what it means. Don't say you're not going to do what you're supposed to do. Help other people. Be involved in community because it's Bittul Torah and you say let other people do it. That's what it means. So it's a very nice... Imri Avraham. It's Parshas Chayisara. Thank you, Moshe. And Rav Price does have a Talmud in Toronto, Dr. Tibor Judah, whom I know. Every time I go there, I... speak to him. Right? Tibor Judah is the son-in-law of... Once the Litvish idea begins, you know, with the Vilna Gaon and the Reb Chaim, I think this was the be-all and end-all. And finally, before I go on, one more thing, because one of you who's not here right now asked me to take a look at today's Wall Street Journal. Lo and behold, I don't even have to look on it online, where often you don't have access to it, because my wife just last week forced me to, she's sick of the New York Times, so she said she wants to read the Wall Street Journal instead, especially on the weekend. She couldn't take the New York Times anymore. So I got the Wall Street Journal, and right here on the front page, right at the bottom, see the Chaf K there? It says, keeping kosher in a corner of Siberia is no picnic. So it's a whole article about how difficult it is for the Chabad to keep kosher in Birobidzhan, that place in the middle of nowhere that they were going to send all the Jews. And okay. The only thing I was thinking when I'm reading that is a big deal. There are Chabadnikim in places a lot harder than in the middle of the Soviet Union in Siberia. It's like the corner of Siberia, they call it. At the end of the day, he has meat there. He has beef. You could stick it on a train. So it said 21 hours. You can get it from Moscow. Anything you want in Moscow. I just got back from 2 weeks of India. Forget the fact that there's no meat in India. There is nothing. Zilch. Nothing imported. Nothing in the supermarket. Everything is made from scratch. And that's the way it is in Nepal and all the other places these Chabadnikim go. So you're in Gan Eden anywhere in the Soviet Union compared to what it is in India, where literally they have to make everything. And let me just show you here for a second. I don't want to talk anymore. Just give me one more minute. I'll show you a few things. Which I saw there. I think you'll find interesting. Well, here, this is right in the middle of Delhi. I was a little surprised because we know what happened in Mumbai with the terrorist attack. This is the big sign right outside the Chabad house. It's in a terrible, terrible area. Not a dangerous area, but you know, very. Well, it's a bazaar, so you got the people running all over the place, and the bicycles, those tuk-tuks, you can hardly walk. But look at it. You see already it's messianic. Melech HaMashiach V'Kayam. And then inside many of the Chabad houses in India are like that. Inside the Chabad house, I took a picture of the sitter. This is the book plate. It says, Yechi Adonenu Moreinu V'Rabbeinu Melech HaMashiach Olam Va'ed HaRebi L'Balabavich Melech HaMashiach Shlita Chai v'kayam lo shinoi de geniza. That means he's still alive without any change of geniza. That is, I think that means he's not, well, it means he's still alive and he's not even in the ground. I'm assuming that's what it means. There's been no change. The fact that we don't see the Rebbe today doesn't mean there's been any change. He's still the same person. He's still alive and there's no shinoi de geniza. He's not even put... You know, these people are not even saying he's coming back, being resurrected to be the Messiah. He's still alive. And et chataya ni maskir. I mean, I daven there. I ate there also, but everyone eats there. All the front people go there. I even read the Torah for them. But right in the middle of davening, we stop and we make a prayer for the Rebbe. You know, they say the Yechi, and then they do it again. It's it was very troubling. Let me just show you also, if you go to Dharamshala, Before I get that, here's another picture. This is what we have to. So here's the show in Delhi, right over the Arun Kodesh. Now in Kweskar Dharamshala, where I was, McLeod, right near Dharamshala, that's where the Dalai Lama is. That's where I went there for the Dalai Lama. I want to see what was doing up there. But you have a bunch of you have a lot of Israelis who are there. There's even signs all over the place. There's signs all over the place in Hebrew. The whole settlement of Israelis, you have Hebrew signs there. But look at the Chabad house. Let me pull it up here. What does this look like now? The guy built a whole Chabad house that looks like 770 in the middle of the Himalayas, right on the edge of the Himalayas, where there are thousands of Israeli backpackers from March to, October or so. It's all Israelis. The signs are all in Hebrew. And, enough with my trip to India. Let us now, although it was very interesting, let us now get back to what we have to do. And I'll get to the questions and everything, comments at the end. And if you want to talk about Elvis also, I tell you some more things. Okay, Rav Yaakov Moshe Charlap. His dates are 1882-1951, and I think I'd be shocked if anyone listening to us now has not heard the name Charlap. Maybe you don't know Rav Yaakov Moshe Charlap, whom we're looking at, but the name Charlap is also an important American Orthodox family because, there was one of Charlap's sons comes to America and is an important rabbi in the New York area, but his son, named Zevulun Charlap, for a number of decades, was the head of Rav Isaac Elchanan Theological Seminary, that is the head of Yeshiva University's rabbinical school, and that is the grandson of Rabbi Charlap. Now, what is this name Charlap? If you look at the name, it's spelled Chet Resh Lamed, then you have the apostrophes, Pei. So it's already an abbreviation. So what we would say in Hebrew, we call it Rosh Tevos. And it goes back hundreds of years, actually, to a man named Chia, who came from Spain. And after the expulsion from Spain, he ended up in Poland and became leader of a community of exiles who had settled in Poland. And Charlap, we're told, is the acronym, the Rosh Tevos, for Chia Rosh Legole Poland. That is Chia, head of the exiles in Poland. Now, this is the information that appears. There's an old Megillas, what they call Megillas Yuchsin, as the genealogical chart from the Charlap family. And the Charlap family goes back to Europe. People wrote Sfarim, name is Charlap. However, and that's what the Charlap family, Rav Yaakov Moshe's family says. But I found that there's another Sefer, another Charlap named Ephraim Charlap, and he wrote a Sefer called Hod Tehillah. And he says, it doesn't stand for Rosh Legole Poland, but rather Rosh Legalil Poland. That is the head of the district of Poland. Now this Charlap, Ephraim Charlap, who was an uncle of Yaakov Moshe, was the Rav of the city of Mezrich, but he was not a Chassid. Rav Charlap, who we see right now, his forefathers were students of the Vilna Gaon. Followers of Vilna Gaon, and the Vilna Gaon, put a great stress on going to the land of Israel, and a number of his students did, and that's what the Charlaps. In 1850, Rav Charlap's grandfather, together with Rav Charlap's father, went on Aliyah, left Europe, came to the land of Israel, and Rav Charlap's father, his name is Zevulun, which is where the Zevulun Charlap of YU gets his name. This Zevulun Charlap, the father of Rabbi Yaakov Moshe Charlap, was a Talmud Chacham. He became a Talmud Chacham in Eretz Yisrael. He serves on the Beis Din of there was a Rabbi Diskin. There were two Rabbi Diskins, as we'll see, but the first Rabbi Diskin is Rabbi Yeshua Leib Diskin. He's the one who comes to Eretz Yisrael. He had been rabbi in a number of places in Europe, in Brisk, incidentally, also in Kovno. He had a very interesting life as well. Hopefully we'll do classes on him. He comes to Eretz Yisrael, though. There already was a chief rabbi of the Ashkenazim, and that's Rav Shmuel Salant. But Rabbi Diskin opens up court, I guess, his own court, and becomes... generally, they got along, but sometimes they didn't get along, and he really becomes an alternative power source, sometimes at odds with Rav Shmuel Salant. Rabbi Diskin issuing his own rulings and his own declarations. I guess you could say he was an unofficial rabbi. He was recognized by everyone, though, as one of the leaders, but he was regarded as more extreme. Now, as I said, the official rabbi of Jerusalem, he had come earlier in 1841. That's Rav Shmuel Salant. Incidentally, he returns from the land of Israel to Europe. At least one time. He had been there since 1841. In 1878, he becomes Av Beis Din, which is the equivalent of chief rabbi, the head rabbi in Jerusalem. And the community actually declared that no takana that Rabbi Diskin says will take effect unless Rabbi Salant agrees. The problem with this was Rabbi Diskin had his followers, and they didn't have to hold by that. Okay, getting back to Rabbi Zevulun Harlap, who was on Rabbi Diskin's Beis Din. The extreme Beis Din. We'll see that Rav Harlap himself, the irony is the one who becomes the follower of Rav Kook, and wait till you hear the things I tell you about, and wait till you see the attacks on him that appear in this pamphlet, he comes from the extreme segment. And he breaks with them. That's what I think is so interesting. But his father, Rav Zevulun, was a great lover of Eretz Yisrael. Don't let anyone tell you that the extremists are not lovers of Eretz Yisrael. It could be they're not. But those are the ones living in Chutz La'aretz. The Satmar Rav, for instance, was not a lover of Eretz Yisrael. He was there for a short time, then he left. In his Sefer, he says there's no obligation to live there. So yes, he's a lover of Eretz Yisrael in some sort of eschatological sense. We'll all return there, and it's the Holy Land. But not in the sense of a lover of Eretz Yisrael, that he needs to be in the land of Israel. He wants to be in the land of Israel. He said there's no mitzvah until the Messianic era. He held against the Ramban. He went by the commentary of the Megillas Esther, who disagrees with the Ramban. But when you take the extremists living in the land of Israel, many of them were great lovers of the land of Israel. And they actually made the point that we are real Zionists. Rav Sonnenfeld, for instance, was a great lover of Eretz Yisrael. Now, he wrote a book, Zevulun, called Yesod Hamala, which actually disagrees with another sefer that put forth strict views when it came to Truma and Meiser. And the reason, as Rav Yaakov Moshe explained, was he thought that if you make it too difficult to observe these mitzvot, that would prevent people from coming on Aliyah. So again, you see someone from the extreme or more extreme community in the land of Israel, but Aliyah is very important. The name of Rabbi Harlap's volume of Teshuvot, that is Rabbi Yaakov Moshe Harlap's, he wrote a number of volumes of Teshuvot, Responsa, and also the name of his yeshiva that he established is Beis Zevul, named after his father Zevulun. We're actually not going to look at his Responsa, simply because if you take out his responsa, it's not like most responsa. The responsa almost have no actual real cases. They're all theoretical. It's called Shelot and Tshuvot, but there's no practical cases there. Even though he was a practicing Rav, as we'll see, he's the Rav of Shari Chesed in Jerusalem, his responsa are not practical halacha. They're simply chakiras. What was his early education? Same place where everyone was educated, the Yetz Chaim Yeshiva. The Yetz Chaim Yeshiva was founded in 1841 by Rabbi Salant, right after he comes to Eretz Yisrael. This was a pretty unique institution. It still exists, but I really don't know who goes there or what the philosophy is. We spoke a good deal about it last semester because Rabbi Zal Meltzer, who was brought in to head it, it was a yeshiva for little kids. That is, it starts as a cheder, and then goes through Yeshiva Katana, and then the Yeshiva Gedola, which is like a kollel, and you could stay there their entire life. It had people from all ages. It was the first Torah institution in the land of Israel for Ashkenazi. For children. You had places where you, like kollel type things, but it was the first school for children and young adults. Before then, anyone who lived there would have to hire a melamed. And the melamed would teach one or he'd teach five at a time. Yeshiva Seitz Chaim is the first, call it a yeshiva for kids, day school, whatever you want to call it. And just to give you an idea who studied there, I have a list here. Let me read off some names so you get a sense of the people who studied at the Eitz Chaim Yeshiva. See Pesach Frank, Yaakov Moshe Charolap, Shlomo Zalman Arbach, Rav Shlomo Gorin, Rav Avram Shapiro, Rav Goldwicht, remember Rav Goldwicht from Keren B'Yavna, Rav Yisrael Fisher, head of the Yedah Haredit, Rav Tzitzel Ezra, Eliezer Waldenberg, Rav Shmuel Auerbach, who was the head of the Peleg, they call it, the extremist section in Jerusalem today. If you follow the politics in Israel, you know that there's the mainstream faction led by Rabbi Steinman, Rabbi Kanievsky in the Haredi world, and then there's the extremist faction that is led by Rav Shmuel Auerbach. And I guess each one of them claims that they're the rightful heir to Rav Yashuv and Rav Shach. And my question always is, why is Rav Shmuel Auerbach trying to argue that he's the rightful heir to Rav Yashuv and Rav Shach? Why doesn't he argue that he's the rightful heir to his father, Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach? I would think that should be more important than being the heir to Rav Yashuv or Rav Shach. But it seems that, unlike Rav Zalman Nechemi Goldberg, his brother-in-law, Rav Shmuel Auerbach is more influenced by others than by his own father. Who else studied there, Rabbi? Avram Yoshua Soloveitchik, the Rosh Hashiva Brisk, Rosh Hashiva Cohen, the list goes on. Menachem Porush, we spoke about him last class as well. So basically, anyone who's anyone studied at the Eitz Chaim Yeshiva. As a young man, Rav Charolap becomes attached to very special individual named Yeshua Tzvi Michal Shapiro, no relation to me. He was a well-known tzaddik and an ascetic in Jerusalem. He was born in Hebron in 1840 and then comes to Jerusalem. He was known as a holy man. And basically, people were sort of like, most people were afraid to go near him because he was so holy and they didn't feel they can come close to him. Rav Charolap goes over to him one day and asks if he could become his student. He was so impressed with his piety. And this man, Rabbi, they call him Tzvi Michal, but it's really Yeshua Tzvi Michal, well, he was a loner. He did his own thing, was by himself, but he agreed. Now, he was an incredible ascetic personality. And we'll see how this influenced Rav Charolap. He also was a Mekubal, a real Kabbalist. Rav Charolap learnt with him as a teenager, day and night, and later on, some other students would also join. Now, Rav Tzvi Michal dressed distinctively. For instance, he wore white. He didn't wear black, and he also wore a white strimal. His outer garment was above his pants, not tucked in, so maybe he looked a little like a schlump. And his students also dressed like this. So just to picture this scene, everyone going around in white, white strimals. I don't even know today where you get white strimals. There's a book. Hold on a second. I hear some noise in my house upstairs. I'm just sending an email. I'll tell him to stop. I don't know if you could hear it, but I hear my son playing his guitar. So I sense that. Okay, there's this book. This is not a biography. It's not a hagiography. It's called Shirat Chaim. It's the story. It's called Shirat Chayav Shel Ish Yerushalayim. What is it? It's just stories. And stories from Rav Charolap. It's a very thick book. And every story, though, is attested who said it. And on page, it's done by a grandson of Rav Karloff. There's a picture in here of the grandson. The grandson is a dati with a big kippah serugah, but you'll see among the descendants of Rav Karloff, some of them are Haredi, and some are religious Zionists. After we get done with Rav Karloff, it'll be a little hard to see how descendants of Rav Karloff could be in the Haredi world and share the Haredi philosophy when you hear Rav Karloff's philosophy. But, I mean, that's the reality. On page 117, among the people who were in, we see among the people who were in Rav Karloff's circle when he was young was none other than Rabbi Amram Blau, the famous head of the Neturei Karta. And the story is, when Rav Karloff passes away, who goes to the funeral? Rav Amram Blau. Now, Rav Amram Blau was the strongest opponent of everything Rav Karloff stood for, the biggest anti-Zionist. So he was asked, how could you go to the funeral of Rav Kook's leading student? And he said, first of all, he's such a great Talmud Chacham that even him I'll go to. But then he says, second of all, in my youth, you know, I studied with him the Torah. So, like I said, Rav Karloff comes out of that world, which is going to make his break so much more significant. Rav Karloff would later publish the Sefer of his Rebbe. It's called Tzitz HaKodesh in 1920. And this actually comes as a famous story. Why did he publish the Sefer of his Rebbe? He had a vision at the Kotel. He had, and now you get a sense of what I mean. What do you mean he had a vision? He had a number of visions. We're going to see about his visions of Rav Kook. He is someone who, well, if either he really is having visions, or if you're not a believer in this sort of thing, then as the Rambam might put it, his imaginative faculty was involved with this. But he definitely is someone who's not in this world. His soul seems to be in a higher world. And let me read you his vision. And that's a famous story. And you find it on page 538. He was once at the Kotel. He would always go to the Kotel because his teacher always went to the Kotel. Rav Tzvi Michal used to always go. So he's at the Kotel, and what happens? He has this vision that they say about Rav Karloff in heaven. That is, he's hearing that in heaven they're saying that they're upset with him because he learned so much Torah from Rav Tzvi Michal, but Rav Tzvi Michal's book is still waiting, and no one has prepared it for publication. So, you know, they want to learn his writings in the Olam HaEmet in heaven, but it needs to be done. His Rebbe up in heaven has Chalishus Hadas, it says, and he needs him to prepare it. And not only that, he says that if you prepare the, in heaven they said that Rav Karloff prepares his Rebbe's book, then his Rebbe will be able to study his own writings, and Rav Karloff will be able to reach the level of his Rebbe. So when you're told you can reach the level of your Rebbe, you prepare the book for publication, I guess. Rav Karloff marries at this time. He gets married at age 16 and his bride is 15. That's the end of the first, I guess, stage of Rav Karloff's life. And if everything went according to plan, he would have remained in that extremist community, a very pious, holy person. And that would have been that, and we wouldn't have been having classes on him, and he would have been, an unusual, interesting figure. However, everything changes in the early part of the 20th century, in 1905, if I recall correctly. And that's when Rav Karloff meets Rav Kook, and his whole life has changed. And we've seen already examples of this. And the most famous one that we dealt with was the Nazir. When the Nazir, you know, goes to meet Rav Kook and is in the same inn, and he hears Rav Kook doing Tikkun Chatzos at midnight, And he's all of a sudden the Nazir now writes, I found a teacher. And there are many other people who came to the Shul Shudas of Rav Kook and were immediately turned into his Hasidim. Because make no mistake about it, Rav Kook was a Rebbe, like a Hasidish Rebbe for many. And the same thing happens with Rav Charlap. Rav Charlap, his life is entirely turned around, and not only does he become a student of Rav Kook, he becomes the closest student of Rav Kook, and really a Talmud Chaver, someone that, with the exception of Rav Tzvi Yehuda Kook, this is the person that Rav Kook was closest with and who loved more than anyone. And I might even be wrong with what I just said. He might even have been closer to Rav Charlap than he was to Rav Tzvi Yehuda, because father and son can have a closeness, but it's not a colleague type of, there's still a father and there's still a son. The relationship we're going to see is a relationship that it's very difficult. Last semester I said this, and one of you, I think it was May Moshe, pointed out the relationship of Rav Baruch Ber to Rav Chaim Brisker. And that is a very similar relationship, the way Rav Baruch Ber and Rav Chaim Brisker, because it went both ways. We have many examples of students who are, just think of students, and let's say Rav Soloveitchik or Moshe Feinstein. We have many examples of students who are devoted to the Rebbe. But how often do we have an example where they're wrapped up in the Rebbe, and their life even revolves around the Rebbe. But how often can you say that the Rebbe's life revolves around the student? I don't even think you say it's Rav Chaim and Rav Baruch Ber. I don't think Rav Chaim obviously loved Rav Baruch Ber, but with Rav Kook was intertwined with Rav Charlap in a way that it wasn't just Rav Charlap who was devoted to Rav Kook. Rav Kook was devoted to Rav Charlap. Yes, Rav Kook is the superior one. There never is any doubt about that. However, Rav Kook as a person is not complete without Rav Charlap. I don't think you can say Rav Chaim is not complete without Rav Baruch Ber. And you certainly cannot say that, Rav Soloveitchik was not complete without Rav Schechter of Wilg or anything. I mean, Rav Soloveitchik didn't need anyone to give him completion, or Rav Moshe Feinstein or anything like that. Rav Kook is not complete without Rav Charlap, and he's also not complete without Rav Tzvi Yehuda and the Nazir, but in particular, Rav Charlap, as we will see. Rav Charlap, getting back, let me just get back for a second, the volume he published. Ritzi Michel dies in 1906, and Rav Charlap edits a couple of his volumes for publication that appear later. Another volume of his, called Sakodesh Volume 2, I found, was published by a grandson. His name was Moshe Eliezer Shapiro. Shapiro is an important name also in the land of Israel. They're not all related. He was the Rav of Atlantic City. Atlantic City used to have a nice kahila of Jews. There were kosher hotels in Atlantic City. Agudas Rabbanim used to have their convention in Atlantic City. I don't know if there's any shuls left in Atlantic City, but that was the grandson of Ritzi Michel. And it's no accident that you have a grandson in America. Just Rav Charlap comes to America, and many, many others come to America from the land of Israel. The land of Israel was full of poverty. During World War I, people literally starved to death. No one could make a living. So you have many people who leave the land of Israel and come to America to become rabbis or other things. So how did Rav Charlap meet Rav Kook? Well, he told the story himself, told the story on more than one occasion. It's also reprinted, of course, in Shirat Hayam. Let me just summarize it for you. I want to open it up so I don't miss anything. It was, I said 1905, actually it was 1904. Shortly before Shavuos in 1904, he had suffered health issues. So why did he have health issues? He had become ill because of all his fasts. He was adopting all these ascetic practices like his Rebbe, Rav Michel, and he made him ill. And the doctors told him, first of all, you got to stop all these ascetic practices. And second of all, in order to heal yourself, go to Yafo. The climate was thought to be very good there. So he goes to Yafo to go to the water, to be tovel in the water, to swim. While he's there, he davens in a certain shul. He's 22 years old. And he heard on Shavuos how Rav Kook recites, Rav Kook, remember, is the chief rabbi of Yafo. How Rav Kook recites Akdamus. We have so many stories about people who hear Rav Kook's davening and how much it affects them. I really wish that I could have experienced that, because you can describe it, but you don't know what this means unless you see it. Rav Zalman Meltzer famously said that Rav Kook's mincha on every day, his everyday mincha, Rav Zalman Meltzer said, I wish that my Yom Kippur davening could be like Rav Kook's everyday mincha. Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach recalled how they would go, the young people would go, to watch Rav Kook daven. And just to watch him. Open up the door a little, see him, because it was something else. So Rav Charlap, who himself knows what it means to be spiritual, he hears he's there in Shul, and he's the Akdomos, the crying and the feeling, and it affected him, he said, Ad Yisod Nafshi, until the essence of his soul. And he says, from that time on, I was attached to Rav Kook with a great Ava, and I was his, he says, Hayiti v'talmido v'chassido l'olam, and I was his student and his chassid forever. But he never went up to Rav Kook. That is, he saw Rav Kook, and he saw his holiness, and he, from that point on, from the time he heard the Akdamos read, he regarded himself as a student and as a chassid of Rav Kook, to go listen when Rav Kook speaks and everything, because Rav Kook was the Rav, he was darshaning all the time. But he was afraid, because of the holiness, to go up Yiras Romulus, whatever you want to call it, he was afraid to go talk to Rav Kook and to tell Rav Kook that he was attached to him. So, this is the whole Shavuos. He was feeling this way. Following Shavuos, he tells the story that on a Shabbos, right after Rosh Shavuos, he's given the honor of taking the Torah out of the Aron Kodesh. Rav Kook was a little surprised, because in that shul, they didn't give the honors to young people. They gave it to old people. So he wanted to know who this person was. So he asked Rav Tzvi Pesach Frank, if you recall, Rav Tzvi Pesach Frank was also in Yafo at this time, to find out who this person was and bring him to Rav Kook. And so Rav Tzvi Pesach tells Rav Kook, who knew Rav Charlap from Jerusalem, he brings him to Rav Kook, and Rav Charlap describes how he went into his house, and they had a long conversation in Halacha and Haggadah and Pilpul and Darshanut. Rav Kook was then 39 years old, etc. So from that moment on, in 1904 until 1935, Rav Charlap was attached to Rav Kook, as they say, with a cord that could not be broken. We'll see later what happens when Rav Kook goes to America. Rav Charlap then doesn't have Rav Kook. But we'll get to that. So we're going to, the rest of the time we deal with Rav Charlap, until Rav Kook's death in 1935, Rav Kook is the most important person in Rav Charlap's life. Rav Charlap's whole life revolves around Rav Kook. Think of a chassid to a Rebbe. This is chassid to a Rebbe on steroids. What chassid, a chassid, admires the Rebbe. But what chassid is with the Rebbe every single day? What chassid's whole spiritual personality is enmeshed with the Rebbe, not just from his written works, but from his private thoughts? It's a relationship almost unheard of. And yet, let me tell you something I mentioned in my last book. There is a very popular Haredi hagiographer. He's written probably 25 books, and I enjoy the books, because generally the facts are okay, and he tells the story, and then you can use that as a basis and then move on. His name is Aaron Sarosky. But there are times that he's not honest. One of the times he's not honest is in discussing Rav Charlap. He has a biography about the Gera Rebbe. One of the Gera Rebbe's, the Re'im, Avraham Mordechai Alter. And he has to discuss Rav Charlap, for reasons I'll tell you in a minute. Why, what does Rav Charlap have to do with the Gera Rebbe? We'll see. But he goes into a whole discussion of Rav Charlap and describes how he's a great student of this great, he calls him Talmud Mufak, of the great Mekubal and Pietist, or Yeshua Tzvi Michal Shapiro, he does not even mention one word about Rav Kook. How is it possible to describe who Rav Charlap was and describe him as a student? This is like the equivalent of when Rabbi Shurkin publishes Rav Soloveitchik's Chidushim, and on the title page, he refers to him as Av Beis Din Boston. Not even mentioning Yeshivas Rav Yitzchak Elchanan. You're saying Rav Charlap, whose entire life from 1904 to 1935, 31 years, was Rav Kook. And although initially, yes, he was a Talmud Muvhak of Rav Shapiro, but that becomes completely subordinated and sublimated to Rav Kook. He doesn't even mention one word. He also neglects to mention that Rav Charlap succeeded Rav Kook as Rosh Yeshiva Merkaz HaRav. And even before, when Rav Kook was alive, that's what Rav Charlap did. That's how he made a living. That's where his Torah was taught. He was a Ram, a Rebbe, in Yeshivas Merkaz HaRav. Now, the problem that Sarovsky had is as follows. The Gerer Rebbe, Avraham Mordechai, it's Yisrael, the Gerer Rebbe Yisrael, Rebbe of Ger Yisrael, after he dies in 1977, in the early years of his reign as a Rebbe, he would come to study Kabbalah with Rav Charlap every Friday. Well, this is a problem now, because the Gerer Rebbe is an important figure in the Haredi world. And if Charlap, and if he's learning with Rav Charlap, in fact, he was mevatel himself to Rav Charlap, and if Rav Charlap is such a great Torah sage that the Ger Rebbe comes to him, well, then you have the problem because Rav Charlap subordinated himself to Rav Kook. And therefore, if we're supposed to look up to Rav Charlap, because the Ger Rebbe he was the Ger Rebbe's Rebbe, and Rav Charlap's Rebbe was Rav Kook, that means that in the Haredi world, they have to regard Rav Kook as one of the special holy people. And that's a problem. And therefore, completely omits any mention. The Ger Rebbe was learning with Rav Charlap, he was the Rosh Yeshiva of Merkaz HaRav Yeshiva. So what does Sarovsky say? It's malpractice. Sarovsky says in this discussion that Rav Charlap's Kabbalistic knowledge all came from Rav Tzvi Michal Shapiro. If he'd say that some of his knowledge is early knowledge, but to say that his knowledge all came from Rav Tzvi Michal Shapiro, that's rewriting history in a very extreme way. And we will see what the extremists in Jerusalem thought of Rav Charlap soon enough. Look, at the end of the day, Rav Kook was the primary influence in Rav Charlap's life, Kabbalistic and otherwise. We even have a document from Rav Charlap. Oh, and we're going to see Rav Charlap's great defense of Rav Kook as well, next class, to the Ger Rebbe. Not this Ger Rebbe, but that Ger Rebbe, the previous one, Rav Avraham Mordechai, because we're going to enter again the whole dispute over Orot. And when the Ger Rebbe comes to Eretz Yisrael to try to make peace, Rav Charlap becomes an important person in that. We have a document from 1904, which Rav Charlap wrote for himself. And we learn a lot about him from this document. At least I think it's a significant document. And it's published in Shirat Hayam, page 83. Whenever you see private documents like this, really, I'm always impressed by this. Public things, okay, even pious people, maybe publicly, they might do things so that people think a certain way about them. But when people privately write things like I'm going to read you, that's so impressive. This is from Tavis, 1904, so maybe it's January or 1904, December 1903. He says that he's telling himself what to do, that he's taken upon himself a neder. Every night get up at Tikkun Chatzos. Wash your hands, say Birkas HaTorah, and then go right into the Tikkun Chatzos. This is not something people are supposed to know about. This is a private thing. To learn at least 5 hours after Chatzos. 4 straight hours in Baba Kama, and then learn an hour of the Eitz Chaim of Rav Chaim Vital and Rav Moshe Chaim Zlotzato's work. Davenet Vasikin. Then he says, when you get up, he's speaking to himself, when you get up at Chatzos, don't stay in bed and say you're going to learn in bed. He says that. He says to himself, that's the Yetzer Hara talking to you. You're going to fall back asleep. Get up and stand up and learn. Go to your shtender, he says. And he goes on, you know, how much, then daven shachris, then you have to eat, and then learn this, and then learn that, and then in the afternoon you learn the Beis Yosef and the Rambam, etc. And then right after Ma'ariv, eat a little, and then say Kriyat Shema, and go right to sleep so you can get up at Chatzos, get up at midnight. Who writes things like this? Not your average person, and I don't think I'm being disrespectful if I say not your average gadol even. You know, to write out a private note to tell you how to structure your life in such a pious way. It's already 9. I have some questions, so I'll take some questions, and we'll stop here for now. When we come back next class, we'll move into Rav Charlap, first of all, being appointed rabbi in Jerusalem, and then we're going to get into some of the real disputes. You know, with the English taking over, you have issues of revising the school curriculum and the great dispute over Rav Kook, which doesn't only turn into a dispute on Rav Kook, it also becomes a dispute about Rav Charlap, because he's so tied to Rav Kook. But Rav Charlap writes the great justification for Rav Kook's Orot. So we're going to have to deal a lot with the dispute over Orot, especially the famous chapter 34, where, if you recall, Rav Kook says that the exercise that the pioneers do is more important than the Yehudim and all these things that the pious people do. Rav Charlap has an entire book, a small book, a kuntres, in which he defends Rav Kook's position in this matter. And then, of course, we're going to move on, and because Rav Charlap's thought, as as a thinker as well, is going to develop even beyond Rav Kook, and Rav Charlap is there when the State of Israel is declared. So something Rav Kook never was able to experience. So we have a lot to do still with Rav Yaakov Moshe Charlap. So let me go back to some of the questions we have here, or comments. Yisrael says that the reason, he quotes Rabbi Schwab as saying, the reason you look to Bittul Torah is because by studying some more, you'll find that indeed the problem was your actions, and you didn't know which one. Okay, same sort of thing. In Germany, there never was this idea that Torah study is the be-all and end-all for everyone. That wasn't the model. Moshe points out that the Chabadnik, it's like Elvis, that he hasn't died. I hate to say it, but we all know the Holzbergs, the Chabad family that was martyred in Mumbai. But not only were they messianists, but the Mumbai Chabad house was the center of false messianism. And if you've seen the messianic Chabad benchers, I've seen them in various places, they were produced and printed in Mumbai. Unfortunately, to India, there's about 15 or 16 Chabad houses in India. It's unbelievable what they have there, because there's about 70,000 Israelis go a year. Most of them are messianist Chabad, and I think even the extremist messianist Chabad. Some are not. Today, the Mumbai one is not. How do you know? Well, you know because they wear the kippah. It says, Yechi. If you go to the Delhi Chabad, there's a thing there. Well, first of all, if you walk into it, there's a thing on the wall which you could take that the Rebbe loves you, and don't give up hope. If you have any problems, you know you can always turn to the Rebbe. He's always there for you, which is, it's almost a Dorei Shalameisim. I don't want to say it's Avodah Zarah, because then it's a problem eating in the place, because the Shlita and all that, but it verges on it. I'll acknowledge that. And you can go to the website, and if you have a problem, you can send it in, and the computer checks the Rebbe's letters, and the answer comes back, so you're still in touch with the Rebbe. That's not the case, though, today in Mumbai, I'm told, and it's not the case in Bangalore, which is it's a tech center. But it is the case in Delhi, it is the case in Varanasi, where I was, it is the case in Dharamshala, and yet these people, none of us would live in a place like that. I don't even want to go back there to visit. But to live in that place, India, the self-sacrifice that these people do. And years ago, I wrote on the Sfarim blog that the doctrine, the Messianic doctrine of Chabad, is now an acceptable doctrine in Orthodoxy. And I'm not speaking religiously, I'm speaking sociologically. It's become an accepted doctrine, like other things, you know, other Hasidic things, which maybe were not. And everyone attacked me. How could I say this? It's possible, it's all that. And I'm speaking solely sociologically. Just go to India and you'll see it's an accepted doctrine. Because everyone comes to this Chabad house, everyone eats there. You don't have to go to India, though. Go to Florence. Florence, the Chabad house in Florence, where the Frum eat there. They don't want to eat at the regular restaurant because it's under they want to eat at Chabad. Chabad's supposedly stricter. And yet there's a big picture of the Rebbe right in front of the Chabad, in the big window of the Chabad house in Florence. And what does it say? Rebbe Melech HaMashiach. Venice. The restaurant in Venice, which everyone eats there, the Hasidim, everyone, and the shul there, is a Messianic shul. And the restaurant's a Messianic rabbi. He runs it. So how can anyone tell me that it's not accepted in Orthodoxy? If the Litvish are davening in these places, and the Hasidim are davening in these places, forget Mark Shapiro. I saw someone who responded to David Berger, and he said, and the biggest proof, he said, was then the Chabad house in Mumbai, if you recall, it was some like Eda Haredi guy who was also killed. And the person said that if this person had no difficulty staying with the Messianic Chabad, then how can you say that any of us should? So again, I'm not speaking religiously. I'm just speaking sociologically. We were sitting at the table and I was with someone else. And when they started doing the Yichi and they got their kids doing it, I said to the guy next to me, and they were saying, Yechi Adonenu, Moreinu V'Rabbeinu, and they were teaching the kids to sing it. And I said to the guy next to me, who I knew from England, I just happened to see him in the Chabad house in Delhi, I said, I don't understand how adults can believe this sort of stuff. And he said to me, it's exactly what I'm thinking, and he's seen more of it, I think he's traveled more. He says, I don't understand how people, actual live adult Jews, can actually believe this nonsense, but they do. And yet we're all sitting there, and it's a whole table of people from America, from Israel, and we're enjoying the hospitality, and none of us say a word. So we were all singing. And then when they come to Yechi Adonenu, there's complete quiet. The only people doing it is the rabbi, and there was another rabbi, another Chabadnik guy there, and the children, a bunch of children, and they're being raised in this false messianism. But, I mean, that's the reality. Let's see, what else do we have here? Moshe says, Rav Shapiro also wrote Ethical Will, Tzilat Sadi, yes, thank you for that. And Moshe says, is there really such a thing as Chabad that's not messianic? I don't think I've met any. If you're interested in the topic, you're from Lakewood, he's no longer in Lakewood, David Lichtenstein. David Lichtenstein, who used to live in Lakewood and now lives in Muncie, he happens to be a billionaire, as I mentioned already, and done very well in finance, but he's a Talmud Chacham as well, and he has this show Saturday night. You can listen to it. And last Saturday night, David Berger was on the show, and they got very testy. I have to say, no disrespect to David Lichtenstein, but he didn't understand really what David Berger was talking about. You can disagree with David Berger. I disagree with David Berger. I even debated him once publicly, but David Lichtenstein did not have a clue what David Berger was saying. And finally, David Berger, go to the show. You can listen to the show on David Lichtenstein's podcast from last Saturday night. David Berger, he calls him Davy Berger, this Lichtenstein, but he's so exasperated after a while, he simply says, he's such a nice person, Berger, but he just loses it and says, I don't understand how you can't understand what I'm telling you. I've said it very clearly, and you just don't get it. And Lichtenstein didn't have a clue. Berger repeated himself 5 times to make clear what he was saying, and Lichtenstein couldn't grasp what Berger was saying. And then it becomes basically a shouting match because Lichtenstein starts giving mussar to Berger, telling him, you're like a Nazi. You know, the Nazis, he said the Nazis took, if one Jew did a bad thing, they put it on everyone, and you're putting it on everyone. And Lichtenstein's point was that not all the Chabadnikim are like that. What I say, Moshe, is There are Chabadnikim who are not Messianic. At least they're not publicly Messianic. They don't say so. I don't know what personally they think. And even the ones, and some of them I'm convinced are not at all. I don't know if that's a minority or not. But even the ones who are Messianic, they're not like I saw in Delhi. That is, they believe, as far as I know, what I've been told, that the Rebbe is going to come back, be resurrected. And they cite the Gemara that says, you know, if the Rebbe is from the living, it's from this, if it's from the dead, it's from, the, what did they say, from Daniel, I think. That's different than the Mishigas that the Rebbe is actually still alive in what we would call occultation. That's a word that's used with the Shia, having this philosophy for the Shia. Muslims, they believe that the 12th Imam, the last Imam, never died, but rather is in hiding somewhere. Mystical, divine hiding. They call it in English occultation. That is, he's remaining hidden, but alive, and he will come back. That's not our Messianic idea. Our Messianic idea has always been that it's going to be just a person, not someone who from the beginning of time has been kept alive in some miraculous way. That's very different than saying that the Messiah is going to come from the dead. They both could be in opposition to traditional Jewish teaching, but one is simply a doctrine, which is a bit strange, more than a bit strange, to believe in a second coming. But the other is actually to deny reality, to not believe. It's like the people who were getting drunk at the Rebbe's funeral because they thought he was going to come up to Chias Maisim or didn't think he was dead. I mean, they have a whole doctrine there that, just like the Midrash speaks about, that God made, the Satan made it that when Moshe was on Har Sinai, that they thought it was time, it had already, sun had already set, so therefore they thought Moshe wasn't coming back. So too that God, we've all saw a vision. You might have thought you saw a body, but it's not really the body of the Rebbe. It's simply an illusion. I mean, they don't believe he's dead, and they don't believe he's in the ground. That's not a question of a false doctrine. That's just again a denial of reality. But as many people have said, just because you're a crazy person doesn't make you a heretic. I don't know. Yisrael says the Rav of my local Chabad in Israel is non-Messianic. I talked to him about it. I've spoken to Chabadnikim. Now, Moshe could say, well, they're not going to tell you. They'll keep it inside. They won't be honest. I don't think so. First of all, when they say Zatzal after the Rebbe's name, already you're halfway there. And when they go to the people in New Delhi, those types, they won't go to the Kever. I've spoken to enough Chabadnikim to know, I think, that, when they start knocking the Messianic types and saying this is totally against what the Rebbe believed, I take him at their word. About the Gemara, that the Mashiach will come from the dead. Yeah, that is raised in the Gemara. Of course, no Jew ever thought that. Not only did no Jew ever think that since Talmudic days, and that was just one opinion, if you would have gone back 25 years during the lifetime of the Rebbe, the Lubavitch Chassidim would be the first ones to say that it's impossible for there to be a second coming, because first of all, they said the Rebbe is never going to die. The Rebbe is going to be Mashiach. But they would have been the ones to say 100% it is impossible for the Mashiach to die and to come from the dead. They'd be the first ones to say it. The Rambam himself says that of course, they make a deal, because the Rambam speaks of Bar Kocha as being killed. But later on, the Rambam speaks about, dead. So it's not just being killed. If the Messiah dies, then he's not the Messiah. That's what the Rambam holds. And their whole Messianic idea is based on the Rambam. Okay, I see that's it for the questions today. So I thank you all very much. As I said, we have a few more classes of Yaakov Moshe Harlap, and then we turn to Rav Aaron Cutler. Rav Aaron Cutler, who I will argue is one of the three most important American Torah leaders in the post-war years. Rav Aaron Cutler 1, Rav Soloveitchik 2, and the Lubavitcher Rebbe 3. So lots of good stuff coming. Good night, everyone. Look forward to seeing you all next week.